You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
And good morning and welcome to this January 31st, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their book, about their process, about their craft. Today, we're doing a little mix of fiction and memoir. I'm with Attica Locke for the first half and debut memoirist Janet Buttonweiser for the second half with her book Guts. I'll mention first that our second Pen on Fire speaker series event of 2018 is taking place next Tuesday, February 6th at Lido Books, and Attica Locke is headlining there. So today you're going to get a little bit of a preview of Attica's book, but she will be appearing next Tuesday at that event. So you can find more information about that at penonfire.com. You can check out that event, check out who she's going to be with, Ivy Pechoda, in conversation with Barbara, so check that out there. Attica Locke's Pleasantville was the 2016 winner of the Harper Lee Prize for Legal Fiction. It's also been long listed for the Bailey's Prize for Women's Fiction and made numerous Best of 2015 lists. Her first novel, Blackwater Rising, was nominated for an Edgar Award, an NAACP Image Award, as well as an LA Times Book Prize, and was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Her second book, The Cutting Season, is a national bestseller and winner of the Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. A former fellow at Sundance Institute's Feature Filmmakers Lab, Attica has worked as a screenwriter as well. Most recently, she was a writer and producer on the Fox drama Empire. She serves on the board of the Literary Foundation of Los Angeles, but it is her latest we're talking about today. Bluebird, Bluebird is published by Mulholland Books, a division of Little Brown, and a huge, huge pleasure to have her on. Attica, welcome.
Hi there. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, I'm excited, and I'm excited to see you today, and I'm excited to see you next Tuesday. It's always fun when we get to have the author on a little bit before, so we get a little preview, little window into the exciting things to come next week.
Yes.
So the book has been out for a little while, but you know, as always, not all listeners may be familiar with it. So I'm going to let you kind of set it up for us, talk about Bluebird, Bluebird, and that'll kind of set the stage for our discussion.
Sure. The novel takes place in rural East Texas. It is the story of a black Texas Ranger named Darren Matthews, who is profoundly ambivalent about being a black Texas Ranger, about being a black Texan even. He ends up in the course of this novel we learn about his career, troubles that he's having within the department, but also he gets sucked into a double homicide in a tiny little town, a little truck stop town called Lark, Texas, where two bodies have washed up in a bayou days apart. One a black male lawyer from Chicago, and the other a local white woman in her, like, 20s. And this ranger has to figure out what do these two crimes have to do with each other. And he ends up getting a kind of odd and uncomfortable assist from the lawyer's wife, who shows up in this town trying to figure out what happened.
Yes. So you talk a little bit about the point of entry of this book for you. Like, did it start with the idea of these two bodies washing up? Did it start with Darren's character? Kind of talk about what the first hook for you as writer was.
Location, location, location. I am, you'll excuse my morning scratchy throat, but
me too.
I am somebody who comes from East Texas. I grew up in Houston, so I am 100% a city girl. But both of my sides of my family, on my mom's side and my dad's side, they all come from tiny little towns in rural East Texas, just up and down Highway 59. So the idea of wanting to tell a story about this particular part of Texas that doesn't always look like the big sky country rolling tumbleweeds of America's imagination about Texas, it very much is kind of like Louisiana's rowdy cousin. It's swampy in parts. It's called the Big Thicket. It's full of you know, lush and scraggly pine trees, and it's just kind of very different visually and culturally than what people think about Texas. And then I wanted to do that, all of that, even through the lens of Black Texas, which is also something that we don't always think about when we think about Texas. But I come from a long line of Black Texans who, you know, we can pretty much trace our roots going back to slavery. It's we never left. And I just wanted to capture all that. I just wanted a piece of all that. So the land and the location was the first thing, and the idea of this double homicide. In fact, Darren was the last piece of the puzzle, because I'd conceived of wanting to write a book series about stories along Highway 59, and every book would be a different crime, a different town. And my agent said, yeah, that's good, but you may want to consider having somebody who really carries us through. And as somebody who'd never written a series before, you know, I took that to heart, that, okay, that maybe that is one of the tropes of the genre that really work. So I started thinking, what kind of a character can move like that? What kind of a character could go, you know, the Highway 59 goes from Laredo up to Texarkana. It's a huge part of the state. Mm. Who moves like that? And it became very obvious that the answer was a Texas Ranger.
Yes.
Right. And then I had to get over my own ambivalence, or not even ambivalence. I've always said I would never write a police officer. I would never write a cop. That I just don't think that I'm interested in looking at the world through the lens of the establishment. I'd rather my main characters be coming from a different point of view. But then I just simply leaned into it and decided that Darren had my same kind of feelings about confusion about what it means to be a Black man as a part of the establishment.
Actually, that brings up a question that I was going to ask you later on, but I think it makes sense now, which is how this book changed you. And I was interested in that. I'd heard you say in interviews before that you never wanted to write from a cop's point of view. And I was wondering if that was part of maybe how this book has changed you, or if it changed you as a writer and changed you as a person. Do you see things differently having written from his point of view at all, or any surprises?
No, I don't think I do. I think what changed me, or what cracked open something within me, was the research for the book. The fact that I read, and actually this wasn't even research, I read the book Ghetto Side by Joe Liofi. And it wasn't, I just read the book because I was interested in the book, but it deeply stuck with me. And because that book was kind of, in a lot of ways, flipping our current cultural conversation about the over-policing of Black life on its head. Because that book posits that, okay, that is a part of the story, but the other huge part of the story is the under-policing of crimes against Black life on which this country was founded. That really kind of cracked something open for me and allowed me to kind of think about some of these issues from a different point of view. Yeah. And there's a Black cop in that book who lives in the area that he polices. And I saw the heart of a man trying to do the right thing. And all of that really just kind of stuck with me when I read that book. And I think that was a shift for me. That was a shift in my point of view. But I think a lot of the ideas that are being expressed through the voice of this Black member of law enforcement are really feelings that a lot of Black folks have, or that I just have, period. They're just... They're the vehicle for telling these feelings is that he's a Black cop. But the feelings about where do I belong in this country, the feelings about when is it okay and safe for me to follow the rules, the constant push-pull of Black American patriotism. You want very badly to feel a sense of love for a country, but you're constantly reminded that the country doesn't love you back. A lot of these feelings, I just channeled them through the lens of somebody dealing with wearing a badge. But they're feelings I've had a long time.
Yeah. It's not lost on me that this book was conceived and written in Obama's America and birthed into... I don't even want to say Trump's America, but Trump's whatever.
Yeah, we're in.
Right. And I always think it's interesting the time and place a book is born into, especially if it was almost unintended or unforeseeable by the writer herself. This feels like that's the case here. That the book is viewed through a very different lens than it would have been viewed if Hillary was in office.
100%. It's so odd. Now, mind you, Trump as an idea was bubbling up when I was writing it. I was writing it during just the fact that he was in the conversation, like for real, that people were taking this seriously. Yeah. That was in there. And then there were also other crazies. There was Ted Cruz with his crazy stuff. I mean, it was already kind of there, but if I'm being very honest, there were moments when I was writing where I thought, oh, Attica, maybe you're turning up this white supremacist stuff a little too much. Maybe it's not really that crazy. And then lo and behold, we all wake up on November 9th, and yes, it is that crazy. I described it to somebody as if we picked up a big-ass rock in the garden and discovered there were all these snakes under it the whole time. You know, I'm even embarrassed the degree to which I didn't see it. I'm actually embarrassed by that I kind of fell for. I mean, I fell for the idea that Obama would really shift things. And in some ways, I saw while he was in office, I saw the way in which just the fact of his presidency was certainly making a lot of ugly stuff come out. But it wasn't being called racism, and it was all toned down. Trump just gave people permission to just say crazy stuff, to just really just kind of own their preference for a very particular white male hetero America that existed a very long time ago. And it is frightening, and I didn't plan any of it. And so it was uncomfortable to me the ways in which I realized the second he was elected, oh my God, my book, like, oh my God, I was writing about all these things, but I didn't really quite see it. I didn't really see it coming. I did not believe he would be elected. I was one of those, one of many people who didn't believe it.
I think many, many people, yeah. And it's interesting to think if you were writing this book today as opposed to 2 or 3 years ago, it would be very hard, I think, not to get thrown off your game of novelist. You know, you have a story to tell. The book has its own parameters and universe. And getting this influx of the news every day, I feel like would have the potential to kind of throw you off your game or make you feel like, now I have to address this issue over here somehow. So maybe it's kind of nice it was written before.
Well, I think that, and then I try to do something. I always, with every book, have a dateline around the first page. I always try and really fix a book in time. Part of it is just a quirk I have as a reader. I don't always like to play the game of what year is it and try and pick up on clues about what people are wearing, what kind of car they're driving, to figure out where we are and at what time. That is so meaningful to me. Setting is so meaningful that I literally just put it right up front. And I was very clear that this book took place in 2016. And in fact, the book that I'm working on, the second in the series, takes place merely a handful of months later. And so, I'm in a first draft, so as long as everything stays the same, it is still 2016, but Trump has been elected. And so I'm just trying to fix it in time so that I can tell my brain, go back to those first months and don't get caught up in all this other stuff that's happened after, because it is overwhelming. And this is not just as an artist. I think we're all, as human beings, quite overwhelmed by the breadth of crazy. I wish I had a more elegant word for it, but it's just the breadth of nonstop insane news that is unsettling. There's no recovery time for it. So I don't know how anybody's doing anything. I don't know how women who work in a tanning bed are running that. I don't know how doctors are doing their job, because it's exhausting. Yeah. It's constant. I will sit up and go, oh my God, remember when he threw paper towels at people who still don't have water? Oh, like you have these moments where months later you remember something, because it's all happening so fast.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it is amazing that anybody is getting, well, I'm getting significantly less done than I think I was, but anyway.
Right.
So I want to talk about some of these characters. These characters are wonderful. They are fully realized. And I want to talk about your process of kind of mining some of these. There are these wonderful uncles, Darren's wonderful uncles, who are both wonderful men and kind of representations. And I wonder about, and you talk about, there's a Belle who you didn't really understand her until you kind of saw her picking her toenail,
right,
toenail
right.
polish. So just kind of generally talk about, you know, maybe which characters gave you the most difficulty trying to find out and dig out who they are and kind of your process for getting into these people's heads.
So
that's kind of a broad question.
Well, I'll say this. The uncles came from, I consider the idea that he was raised by twin uncles, whenever it just popped into my head, it was a gift to me. And probably the reason why it could pop into my head is that I had two twin great uncles who are identical twins who were quite different. They certainly weren't, you know, rivals for a woman's affection, or they certainly were not nearly as different as the men in the book. But it was just fascinating to me, this idea. I always thought it was fascinating when I was growing up that they were so different but looked exactly alike. And it provided this really great poetic way to speak about a fracture in the black psyche between people who one uncle is a constitutional law professor who has very clear ideas about where the law is problematic for black folks, where it doesn't work for us. And the other one was a Texas Ranger who firmly believed that the law, you know, could really change and support black life. So that was just a wonderful, it just popped in my head. A lot of the stuff that happened for me is truly, it's I trust my unconscious so much more than my conscious mind.
Yeah.
I feel like my unconscious is a better writer than my conscious mind. I just lean into the things that pop into my head. And a lot of times I learn who people are just simply through behavior, and which is what I was saying in that interview about Darren's mom, Belle, that I knew he had this mother. I knew that she came from a different class set. I knew a lot of stuff. But it was not until I wrote that first scene that I felt like I knew who she was. And that happens for me a lot, that it's in people's behavior that I kind of figure out who they are. But I don't know how to explain how the behavior just pops into my head.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I could come is the fact that because I have another life where I'm sometimes a screenwriter, and because I was a screenwriter before a novelist, and I did so much theater in high school, that behavior, I think there is a part of me that has a dramatist inside me, like at all times. And so, because the easiest writing for me is if I just put two people in a room. It is not quite, but nearly like turning on a faucet. It doesn't mean that, like, all of it will be great, but I don't have to reach for it. When I write just straight-up prose, I can be on a paragraph for 2 hours. It's just not all prose, but sometimes when I'm trying to express something in a way that is accessible, that doesn't sound super writerly, that kind of stuff is hard.
Yeah.
I find that stuff really hard. But I find character work and dialogue very easy.
So is that how you do it? You put these people in a room together and kind of flesh them out that way and then backfill it with, you know, all the messy prose crap that the writers have to do?
No, I mean, I write it straight through. It's
okay.
Just when I'm in the sections where I'm having to do prose, that's slower. It's a lot more slow.
Okay.
It is. It's just more slow.
Yeah. Yeah. And your dialogue is so wonderful. I mean, all these characters sound so totally unique and totally distinct from each other, but also, I mean, you know, it's so visual. Your screenwriting abilities really come through in this. I mean, it really feels
glad.
Like a movie.
I think I'm trying to come to a place where I balance the two worlds, and they speak to each other in nice ways. And I've really learned to kind of use the novelist in me in a script, and then use the scriptwriter in me in a novel. So I think they're learning to kind of talk to each other.
Yeah, right. And that is how it feels. That is how it feels. So I'm always curious about crime. I love reading crime fiction. I think it'd be so difficult for me to write. And so for the crime, aspiring crime writers out there, talk a little bit about dissemination of information, cliffhanging, moving the story forward. Like, it feels like it has to be so tight and so intentional and yet feel very organic and authentic. And so I'm trying to get how crime writers balance all those things. You know, is it a process of outlining? Is it, you know, the reader needs to know this here?
What's funny is when I read other people, I feel like I don't know how they do it. I'm reading Alastair Burke's The Wife right now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, how is she structured? How is she doing this? Or sometimes when I read, Leanne Moriarty has this very particular way of structuring things where you know the what before you know the why.
Right. Yes.
And I don't know how she does that. So it's funny that I marvel at other people's ability to do it as well. But for me, I really think it's I don't want to sound so like I was just born to do it, but it's so rhythmic for me that I don't always have to think about it. There's sometimes just I don't want to act like shit just falls from the sky. I mean, there are moments of profound structuring, but I wouldn't say that that's my overall real process. And I don't create an overall outline. I came as close to doing that with this as I ever have because I really wanted it to be a shorter book than my other books. But a lot of times I'm just figuring out as I go through, and then I just literally have a felt sense of, oh, something needs to turn here.
Yeah.
What can I throw in? I don't know how to explain it, but I definitely go by feeling. I definitely go, I think I have a felt sense of how mysteries need to lay themselves out or when something new needs to kind of grab a reader. But also, readers should know, and burgeoning writers, mystery writers should know, you can fix all this later. So the first draft can be messy as all get out. And later, I've written a whole, gone all the way through and decided somebody else did it and rewrote it. I mean, all of it can be fixed later, so it comes out looking as if it was all polished. But a lot of that is trial and error and the willingness to course correct, what I'm saying? So, and like I was talking about behavior before, with this book, I knew who did it. I knew why. With other books, I didn't know who did it. But somehow in going through the process of taking the journey, people's behavior would kind of whisper to me. Like, I don't want to give anything away for my book Pleasantville. But it just kind of started whispering to me, I think that guy is the one who did it. And then later I will go back and plant clues. So it's not like I had the clues there to begin with. Later I will go back in and bury clues.
Okay. So interesting. I always read these books. I'm like, I still can't solve a Scooby-Doo mystery on my own. So this is not the genre cut out for me, but my guest this morning is Attica Locke. The book is Bluebird, Bluebird, and you are tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So I want to get back to setting, which was the driver for this book, and so wonderful. This is part of the world that I have not been in. But I talk to a lot of writers who return to this childhood place a lot, and I think writers' minds kind of rest I always say they always rest at the place where they had all these early memories before they had the language to process the memories, so they spend their whole life going back there and trying to figure it out. Do you think it is easier to write about that part of the world not living there now? Is it, giving yourself the distance to kind of have more perspective on it, or do you go back and visit a lot? You've described some of these towns as being so, I want to go there now and see some of these crazy things.
I do go back home a lot. I do go back to Texas several times a year and still feel a sense of a profound connection. But I think something you just said almost bringing me to tears a little bit, what you just said about you go back to a time where you don't have language to explain. And so for me, there was something in particular about about this book that I've called a love letter to Black Texas. And the literal dedication page is a list of my ancestors. And I said that for these people who said no. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with a special family. On both sides of the, my mom and my dad both come from rural Texas farming families and literally out of dirt made PhDs and doctors and politicians and lawyers. And this odd mix of the cosmopolitan and the agrarian is what I saw growing up, and I didn't understand how special it was. But I think now, to be able to write that and to capture that, there's a very specific experience of Black Texans that I wanted to write down and that I grew up around my whole life. I mean, part of the thing about writing on Highway 59 is that I spent so much of my childhood on this highway visiting relatives. and with, you know, pre-iPads and Game Boys and any of that, all I would do in the back of the car is look and daydream and see all of this stuff that I, that is like a rural fantasia. The little cafes and the bayous and the truck stops and the fruit stands and the people that you would see and the antique shops. And it was just, I just kind of grew up around all of this. And I think you're right about the reaching back, because it's like part of understanding your world is to go back to the initial first micro world that you saw. And if you could make sense of that, maybe you can begin to extrapolate and understand more about the larger world.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I talk to so many writers who just keep treading through that. And I think to your point earlier about how much smarter your subconscious is mind than your conscious mind is what makes fiction so rich, because it makes it unpredictable. And it really is the writer with their, you know, cerebral talent of putting words together, working through all the muck of the psyche.
Right.
Is so mucky.
Yeah.
And that's always so interesting. I mean, these characters are so psychologically complex, and all of that, I think, has to be done in the subconscious mind, because the conscious mind can never understand these things.
Right. And then I also, frankly, use my own personal therapy that I've been in for however many, 15 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. I use that as a part of my process. And what I mean by that is, I thank my therapist in every single book, and for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think any book would exist without her cheering me on and without her telling me to trust my unconscious all the time and to trust that when I'm not writing, my unconscious is still working stuff out. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, it helped alleviate a lot of guilt when you couldn't quite get to the work, to trust that you've put something in motion that your unconscious is you know, needing and worrying over and figuring stuff out. It will be there for you the second you can sit down again. That's been very meaningful to me. But then also studying my own psychology and studying the psychology of the people around me, I think has given me a greater understanding of human psychology in general, and I think has made that part of my work a lot stronger.
Interesting. I love that. I love that. Okay, now I don't feel as guilty. Well, I might. All the time. We're drawing down on our time, and you've left so much good advice. But is there something we should have covered that's good writing advice that has sustained you over the years that would be helpful for writing audience?
I think the number one thing, and I struggle with it today, is to be kind to yourself through the process. It is the idea of making up something from nothing is a wild, it's a wild dream, it's a wild endeavor, and beating yourself up along the way is not going to get you there. I firmly believe that to the best that you can, just be really kind and remember that your anxiety and your excitement are chemically similar in the body. So sometimes we get anxious, I can't do it. You're actually just excited because you're trying to do something great. And just along the way, pat yourself on the back and be kind. And, you know, just show up for it as often as you can and don't beat yourself up. It's not every day.
Attica Locke, you're awesome. And you're going to be here on Tuesday. So if you're a local and you want to come see Attica, hear her talk more Tuesday at the Pen on Fire Writing Salon. And you have a wonderful website, which is your name, right? Attica Locke.
Yeah, it's just atticalocke.com. Yeah.
Yeah, there's great stuff on there. So many other wonderful books. Attica Locke, huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Janet Buttonweiser will join me for the second half. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. As I mentioned, we have another awesome speaker series event coming up next Tuesday, February 6th at 7 o'clock. At Lido Books, Attica Locke, who was on in the first half, will be with Ivy Pachota and Barbara. Check them out there. I am your co-host for the hour, Marie Stone, onward with the show. Janet Button-Weiser's work has appeared in The Rumpus, Under the Sun, Potomac Review, The Pinch, Bellevue Literary Review, and elsewhere. Her memoir, Guts, was a finalist for the University of New Orleans Publishing Lab Prize and is published by Vine Leaves Press this coming February, coming up in, I think its birthday is like 2 weeks from yesterday. So it is soon to be out. Her work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, was a finalist in Oregon's Quarterly Northwest Perspectives Essay Contest, and won honorable mention in the Atlantic Student Writing Contest, the New Millennium Writers Award, and the Art Smith Literary Award. She holds an MFA from Northwest Institute of Literary Arts. A huge pleasure to welcome her on to talk about her memoir, Guts. Janet, welcome.
Hi, Marie. Thanks so much for having me.
So I was going to say, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll let our listeners know that you and I met in the summer of 2016 when we were workshop mates at Tin House. And for those writers looking for great one-on-one mentorships without getting the full MFA, I just so highly recommend these workshop programs, whether it's Tin House or Sewanee or Breadloaf. They're such awesome experiences.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah. Have you done others beyond the Tin House?
I've done also the Taos Summer Writers Conference, which sadly is no longer in existence.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're just wonderful. So we met there almost 2 years ago, and I know the memoir was done or nearly done then, and I'm loving watching it kind of be born into the world. So in 2 weeks.
Yes, thank you.
It's like you're on the delivery table right now. And you sound like you're doing so well.
Yeah, not too much pain yet. Epidural has kicked in.
That's coming, yeah. That's coming. So I'm going to let you lead off with an introduction to the memoir and allow you to take us into your story, and that'll sort of set the platform for talking about it. But take us into Guts and your journey.
Sure. So when I was 26, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease and was treated for 2 years, and then that actually turned out to be a misdiagnosis. It turned out that I had a benign tumor on the outside of my intestine, and a couple surgeries later, I was all better, and then the tumor came back a few years later, and I had another surgery and now have a permanent colostomy. And so part of the book is about that journey and the experience of being a young female, unassertive patient and how I had to learn how to advocate for myself. And the other part of the story is, as a lifelong shy person, I've discovered that a good plan is to surround yourself with assertive people. So I had a close friend named Beth who would bolster me and was definitely part of my informal caregiving team throughout my illness. And then she developed brain cancer, and when we were both 38, she died. And I know it sounds like I'm giving away a lot of the story. The information about her death is something that readers know from the very beginning. And so it's also a story about having that experience also happen as a young adult and, you know, learning really how to assert myself on my own.
Kind of, well, it's a lot of dealing with life events that you wouldn't normally have to deal with until you're, you know, 70s or 80s, in your 20s, kind of life flipped upside down in a lot of ways. And
right.
Yeah, so great. At what point in your journey did you decide this was a book you either wanted or maybe needed to write? I mean, was it always, as you were living through this, a way for you to process what was going on with you? Or did you kind of look back at it after all was said and done and say that would make an incredible memoir?
So I would say that I had the idea of writing it from the very, very beginning. Writing was something that I had done informally, you know, as a teenager and a even younger adult. And so I did, I think, have the idea and the fantasy about writing about it. And
during the, particularly in the beginning of my illness, I was listening to a lot of This American Life, which I just adore. And I think I had a fantasy of writing a story for them and reading it. And so I did a fair amount of research about that. And what I learned is that what they talk about, and that what turns out to be true of writing in general, now I know that I've taken some writing classes, is that you can't just write this, oh, this crazy thing happened to me, or this terrible thing happened to me story, and have that be that. It really has to be beyond the story itself and beyond the person who it's happening to. And so I didn't really do very much writing, a lot of thinking about it, but I think that for the experience of the health issues, I really had to let time pass before I could write about it in earnest. And so it was several years after I was completely well that I really started kind of writing seriously and took some writing classes, and then decided that I really wanted to have a lot of support in making this into a book. So I enrolled in an MFA program. And at the time that I enrolled, my kids were both adopted, so my son was about a year and a half, and we had put in paperwork to adopt a second child. And toward the end of my first semester of my MFA, we got a phone call saying, someone has chosen you, and there's a baby due, and she was born a week later during spring break, so very convenient. Right. And I just stayed in school, insanely enough, so I had these two tiny children. And I was writing, and then a few months later, Beth died, and I was still in school, and so perhaps it was just the practical reason of having assignments and deadlines. But I found that her death and my processing about it was really all that I could write about. So I was kind of going back and forth between writing about this experience that had happened several years ago with my health, and then writing about in this very raw way in the immediate aftermath of my friend's death.
Right. Were you keeping journals through all of this? I know you were a writer all the way through, but was there, through the early stages of your illness, were you a journal keeper, or were you drawing mostly on visceral memory?
I'm not as much of a journal keeper, so no, I actually wasn't. I did need to, do a little bit of research in terms of getting my medical records and so forth. But I also, even though I don't keep journals, I have a really good memory, especially for things that seem like unimportant details.
and so bad events, probably, too.
That was very helpful.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about shaping, you have life happening, but then, as you say, it needs to be a story that's bigger than the person and have universal themes and it needs to be kind of shaped into a story-like arc with, an obvious point of entry and an obvious point of exit. All of that, when I, if I look past my own life, would be very difficult. So let's talk a little bit about taking this massive amount of life stuff and shaping it into a narrative. Let's first talk about sort of point of entry and deciding on where the book opened. And I don't know if it even would make, I'm just thinking of this now, make sense for you to read the first couple of paragraphs so listeners can kind of get an idea of where it opened.
I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, why don't we do that and then talk kind of about deciding at that point of entry.
Okay, great. So I'll just read the first couple pages of the prologue.
Yeah, perfect.
September 12th, 2009. It was the middle of the triathlon as race volunteers prepared to eject me from the course. 11 weeks, 3 days, and 7 hours since the moment time divided into before and after. As I pedaled uphill, I didn't consider the way that my Lycra outfit accentuated my colostomy pouch rather than concealing it, the hems of my shirt and shorts meeting at the place where surgical scars formed a lopsided tic-tac-toe board near my navel. I didn't think about my friend Beth. My mind wasn't even on my husband and children back home in Seattle. My brain focused on the clock, the hours that had gone by since the starting gun went off, the minutes remaining before the course would close, the seconds that would pass between the belief that I could make it and the moment that I knew it was too late. Should I just stop there?
Yeah, why don't you stop there? It's, okay. I mean, there's so many wonderful things about this paragraph because it sets up so many of the themes of the rest of the book. And I don't know if you kind of had that. I'm sure you had that in mind as you were structuring this. But talk a little bit about kind of deciding where you were going to start the story, weaving in some of the themes of being both a triathlete, you know, a...
Yeah, so that was definitely one of the things that really changed a lot over the course of... This was actually, originally I wrote it as an essay collection, and chronologically things were quite out of order in the first draft. And then I spent a lot of time, like years, kind of putting things back in order. I think that I'm glad that I wrote it the way that I did, but I think that when you use an alternative structure, whatever structure you use, you have to have a good reason for using it. And kind of over time, I realized that this was a story that really needed to be told in chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
And so... this prologue, which is in the middle of the story, was the prologue for a really long time. And then when I started submitting it to agents, I got a lot of feedback that made me decide to take it out, which is that people thought it was like a sports memoir, which it isn't. I mean, the triathlon is definitely a theme in the story, but it's more of a metaphor than this is me training for a triathlon, and that's the entire story.
Right.
So actually when I submitted it to Vine Leaves, the prologue wasn't in there. It just started where chapter one starts, which is when I am first, when I get the Crohn's disease diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor at Vine Leaves, not knowing that anything about the prologue, came back to me after she read it, and she said, I'm wondering about if we should start the story, you know, that part that's in the middle of the triathlon where you get kicked off the bike course? How about if you started it there? Could you write, like, a prologue? And I was like, oh, actually, I have one right here handy. So I think that... in the end, it really makes sense to start in the middle and kind of get all this information. This person has had these health issues. She's just had a friend die. And then to kind of take you a few years before all of that.
Right. And there's so many wonderful metaphors in here. I mean, the triathlon is a wonderful metaphor. There's this great, your parents and you grew up in Boston, and there's this wonderful image of you live in Seattle now, they are still in Boston, and there's only one road that connects the two of you that runs across the entire country. There's so many of those in this book of, you know, I don't know if they felt like natural metaphors or natural images and symbols, or if they emerged that way when you, you know, kind of thought about them over time. But was that... Did it feel organic when you came across one of those to say, this is just the perfect thing? The triathlon is just the perfect metaphor for kind of how life works.
Yes, it did feel organic. And I think it took me a long time to realize that, particularly about the triathlon, that it is really a metaphor just to tell listeners, so in the beginning of the book, the prologue that I read a little bit from, what happens next is that I've missed the time cutoff for the bike, which is the middle leg of the triathlon, and I don't get to do my last lap, and so I get kicked off and just have to continue the race. And I now feel very appreciative that happened, because it is such this
right.
perfect metaphor for the whole experience and for everybody's experience. It's like, well, sometimes there's this literal barricade, or, you know, more often a non-literal barricade in front of you, and you have to figure out how to go around it.
So in terms of shaping the story of what to include and what to leave out, are there, you know, 300 more pages of the story that you felt like it just doesn't quite fit in with the narrative, I'm going to have to let it go?
There, not 300, but yes, a lot of things. I tend to overwrite, so it's like a process of, you know, here's a long thing and then paring it back. And there were things that got put in and taken out and put in and taken out. And so this actually, is definitely a pared down thing that I had to really over time. I mean, I guess I would say the other thing about the writing process for me was I'm glad that I wrote the initial draft right after Beth died, but I'm also glad that a lot of time passed for me to revise, and so that I could be a little more distanced from the experience. And, you know, I think that particularly when experiences are raw, you tend to want to include everything that happened. And so the distance allowed me to be like, okay, this actually doesn't drive the story forward, even though it's a really important thing or a touching scene or whatever. It needs to come out and could be more kind of emotionally distant from that.
I think that's a really good point for writers, especially memoirists, to remember, is that it's very hard. I mean, I think it's great to take notes during events, but I do feel like I'm trying to remember the year Beth died. What year did she die?
Oh, 2009.
Okay. And then when did you feel like you could kind of see it with the enough objectivity to write about it? Was that like 2013 that you started writing that section?
No, I started writing the Beth stuff in 2009.
A few
months after she died. But I would say, yeah, it was maybe like 3 or 4 years later that I could finally sort of be more distant from it.
Yeah, I do feel like that's about the amount of time that it takes to sort of, have the perspective of what's serving the story versus what's serving your own emotional healing, you know, in situations like this. So that's
right.
My guest this morning is Janet Buttonweiser. The book is Guts, and it is out 2 weeks, next February 13th, right?
Yes.
When it comes out. I love this. I love it. One thing I think that I marveled at in here and that I think a lot of memoirists struggle with is going, you know, they always tell memoirists, go deep. Okay, now go deeper. Okay, now keep going deeper. Get more vulnerable. Get more vulnerable. And I don't know if that came naturally to you. It felt so natural in the book that you were so honest and so, you know, you didn't hide behind all the veils and screens that I think a lot of memoirists tend to do. Tell me a little bit about that. How hard that was for you? I also imagine going through what you've gone through, the medical establishment just has a way of stripping patients down, I think, to, I don't know if that made this easier or harder to write about, but talk about that process of just being so authentic and so honest.
I think, you know, again, because I was writing from a temporally distant place about the medical stuff, that being raw and honest about that came much more easily, and then the being honest about and really digging in to my friendship with Beth, and that whole experience was very difficult. Mm-hmm. Even though I was writing about things that had happened several years before she died, it was really hard to kind of, you know, to say anything negative about her, and to write sort of negative feelings that I might have had or things that happened that were difficult. So at times it was quite wrenching to write about all of it. And I really have to give my thesis advisor, who has become a close friend, a lot of credit, Anna Maria Spagna. Hmm. She just was really in there with me and, you know, just a really good combination of very understanding and sympathetic about how hard it was, and also just, like, not letting me get away with writing at the surface of it. Mm. And, you know, sometimes I would be like, oh, I just can't do this. I need to take a semester off. And she would be like, you know, no, get up off the mat. You're good. You can do it. Uh-huh. So
this
was a very supported. And then I also had a lot of people reading it. And so I had a lot of support that way all the way through.
Yeah, the observation that the emotional parts of it are harder to get at than the physical parts of it, I think, is really interesting and really true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your relationship with Beth, as readers will discover, is not, you know, a Pollyanna easy friendship. It's a complicated. Women's relationships, I think, are so interesting. I mean, they're so complicated and messy, and I think even if we are honest with ourselves, it's hard to understand exactly what's going on between women all the time. So,
right.
So good job there. That's hard territory to mine. So it was great.
Thank you.
And then talk at you. So I know you said you had a lot of readers. How much input do you allow the players in the story to have in their own story? You know, like I mean, your husband plays a big role in this. Your parents play a fair role. Do you allow them to comment, or does that throw you off your game?
That throws me off my game, and so the only person who I allowed to comment was Kevin, who's Beth's, at the beginning of the story, her boyfriend, and then becomes her husband. And I just really wanted to make sure that he was okay with what I was saying about her in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But my husband didn't read it until it was polished. And, you know, other people, I guess those are those people are the main people that I would maybe have concerns about. But, you know, before I sent it off, he did okay everything. But for the most part, I found it challenging to keep people out of my head while I was writing, and so that I needed to not really show it to those people.
Yeah. Wise advice. Oh, we're out of time. Is there writing advice that you would leave listeners, having gone through this journey and process and come out the other side, that kind of sustained you through it, or writing advice that you would advocate?
I guess related to what I was just saying, I think that particularly when you're writing memoir or nonfiction, it is really hard to not have those people in your head. And I would just say to do whatever you can to get them out of your head, particularly in the early drafts. I got a piece of advice which I think I did a pretty good job of following, which is to make up a character that you're writing to. So I had a woman who was like a new and trusted friend who I was telling the story to, and I named her Jenny, which was the name of my imaginary friend when I was a kid. And so every time that I would think, oh, you know, what's my mother going to think, or what's Beth's brother going to think, or whatever, I would say, well, I'm just writing this for Jenny. And then, so I think it's really important in those early drafts to really get down the story that you want to tell. And then you can worry later on about who's going to read it and what they're going to say and what you need to do to honor people and protect them and, you know, let them know ahead of time what you're saying.
Yeah, excellent, excellent advice. Janet Budden-Weiser, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really great to be on your show.
Yes, hold on and we'll talk after.
Okay.
The book is Guts. It is out February 13th, and it is a wonderful read. You can find Janet online. She's got great information about herself, about the book, appearances, all of that on her website. Check her out there. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.